Today is Thursday, August 28th, and this is the World Socialist Website. The 1619 Project Revisited, a retrospective evaluation in light of Trump's assault on democracy, by Tom Mackeman and David North. 6 years ago this month, on August 14th, 2019, the New York Times launched its 1619 Project, a sprawling multimedia attack on the American Revolution and Civil War, the two revolutions that shaped the American Republic and democracy. The true founding of the United States, Project creator Nicole Hannah-Jones claimed, was not in 1776. It was instead in 1619, when the archive first attests to the arrival of enslaved Africans in colonial Virginia. The rest of American history, the 19th Sextet insisted, was one long dark night of racism, only occasionally countered by the efforts of Black Americans who, quote, fought back alone, unquote, to redeem democracy. In launching this enterprise, the Times proclaimed that it was setting out to alter decisively how the American Revolution and the Civil War were taught to students. The text of the original essays that comprised the August 14th publication was reprinted in the tens of thousands for distribution to schools throughout the country. Henceforth, the American Revolution and Civil War would be understood as shameful chapters in the history of American racism. Its leaders, from Washington to Lincoln, would be forever deprived of their undeserved reputation as heroes of democracy. Immediately recognizing the Times 1619 Project as an exercise in historical falsification, the World Socialist website published a systematic rebuttal on September 3, 2019. This was followed by a series of interviews with leading historians, including James McPherson, Gordon Wood, Victoria Bynum, James Oakes, Dolores Janewski, Adolph Reed Jr., Richard Carwardine, and Claiborne Carson. These interviews and articles were read hundreds of thousands of times and drew national and international media attention. On July 4, 2020, the WSWS hosted a webinar with Wood, Carwardine, Oakes, Bynum, and Carson. The discussion drew an international audience from 72 countries, with about 3,000 live viewers and many thousands more in the following days. The panel addressed major historical problems, including the impact of the Declaration of Independence, the roles of Jefferson, Lincoln, and Douglas, the global effects of the Civil War, historiographical debates about revolution, class, and race, and the deepening crisis of social inequality. The WSWS intervention, which also included a lecture series held at major American universities, laid bare the 1619 Project's major errors and distortions, its portrayal of slavery as a uniquely American original sin, unconnected to the emerging global capitalist system, its erasure of the multiracial character of the abolitionist civil rights and labor movements, its insistence that all contemporary social ills descend from anti-Black racism, allegedly rooted in a national DNA, and Hannah-Jones' ignorant claim that generations of white historians had censored discussion of slavery. As the WSWS explained, these fabrications revealed an overarching effort by the Times to promote racial division among American workers and youth by imposing a racialist myth on American history, an attempt, in the words of Times editor Dean Baquet, quote, to teach our readers to think a little bit more, unquote, in a racial way. The project would itself both symbolize and project an almost zoological theory of history, which posited that only Black people could intuit Black history. New York Times Magazine editor Jake Silverstein said, quote, we knew from the beginning that we wanted the magazine to be almost entirely comprised of contributions from Black writers, thinkers, photographers, and artists. This was non-negotiable, unquote. Of all the 1619 Project's many distortions and outright fabrications, its central lie and the one from which all the others flowed, was its claim that the American Revolution and Civil War were not progressive world historic milestones in the struggle for democracy and human liberation, in spite of the many limitations imposed on them by their times. According to Hannah Jones, they were indeed not revolutions at all, but counter-revolutions animated by a super-historical white hatred of blacks. The British Empire, she suggested, was the progressive force in the American Revolution. As for the Civil War, there was no difference between North and South. It was a war between equally racist brothers. This position, with all its vast implications for both U.S. and world history, ultimately boiled down to the claim that there never was a democratic revolution in America, and that therefore it has no democracy worth defending. 6 years ago, the WSWS warned that the 1619 Project's sweeping denigration of the American Revolution and Civil War would hand a powerful weapon to the far right. We explained, quote, "By repudiating these foundational struggles, the New York Times has provided an opportunity for Trump," who quickly seized the opening by menacingly pledging to impose, quote-unquote, patriotic education so that, quote, "our youth will be taught to love America," unquote. As the WSWS predicted, the 1619 Project gave ammunition to state and federal efforts to police education, ban books, and enforce nationalist curricula, including most recently Trump's attack last week on the Smithsonian Institution. The Times' effort to create a black nationalist reframing of American history has provided an opening for the attempt to officially enforce a white nationalist. The politics of the 1619 Project played no small role in Trump's victory. The 2024 election saw pronounced shifts among poor and working-class voters, including an historic increase in support for Trump from black Americans, more than doubling his share from previous cycles. In reconsidering the struggle over the 1619, 6 years later, we have no interest in scoring points on the beleaguered and largely discredited Hannah Jones, who was, after all, never more than a figurehead. Our purpose, rather, is to pose the question of what lessons can be drawn from the experience. One of the crucial problems exposed by the entire affair is the protracted decline in American intellectual life. The decades-long promotion of identity politics and academia and the corresponding attack on Marxism, materialism, social class, and the very concept of progress in history, what the postmodernists deride as meta-narrative, has contributed significantly to the vulnerability of the population before the fascist threat. If, as Hannah Jones claimed, the promise of liberty and equality spelled out in the Declaration of Independence, quote, were false when they were written, if, as she insisted, the Civil War was waged to achieve a, quote, reconciliation with the former Confederates and the restoration of white supremacy, unquote, then there is no American democracy to defend. Not the Declaration of Independence, not the Constitution, not the Bill of Rights, not the Civil War amendments that expanded citizenship and due process to the entire population, including the children of immigrants, a massive share of the American population, past and present, that the 1619 Project mentions not at all. The 1619 Project must itself be understood in class terms. It is not simply that the Times was mistaken about history, or that it miscalculated in its embrace of racialist politics before the 2020 elections. The 1619 Project catered to the worldview and class interests of the Democratic Party's base in the privileged upper middle class. It is this layer of the population that seeks to obscure the class question in the past and present in favor of various forms of identity, through which it hopes to milk positions and benefits in the present. The Times was clearly not alone. In the wake of its publication, left academics and the various pseudo-left groupings that orbit around the Democratic Party, as if to a man and a woman, rallied to endorse and propagate the 1619 Project's claims, framing dissent as bad faith or even racist, and shutting down genuine scholarly debate. This attack was aimed, above all else, at the WSWS and the principled scholars it had interviewed. And where are these forces now? What have they to say about the Gaza genocide, the growth of dictatorship and inequality, The Advancing World War. Hannah Jones, who made millions off the 1619 Project, has been mute, authoring one article in the last 2 years for The Times, though in a recent NBC interview, she claimed that Trump's policies are aimed at making, quote, working white people feel racially ascendant and powerful, unquote. As for the pseudo-left groups that proclaim the 1619 Project, they have been largely silent in the face of the encroaching dictatorship of the Trump administration. Jacobin, for example, has not produced a single article or comment opposing Trump's deployment of federal troops to Washington, D.C. Its editors are awaiting a lead from the Democratic Party. Working class people, white, black, and immigrant, for whom the defense of democracy is a life and death issue, could not be so indifferent. On June 14, 2025, more than 6 million people participated in the No Kings protests across over 2,000 cities and towns throughout the country, making it one of the largest coordinated demonstrations in U.S. history. The massive turnout saw protesters carrying handmade No Kings sign, an explicit invocation of the anti-monarchist spirit and democratic principles of the American Revolution as they rallied in opposition to rising authoritarianism. Long ago, Marx perceived that the first two American revolutions augured a dramatic development of the class struggle. American Civil War, the workers of Europe, quote, felt instinctively that the Star-Spangled Banner carried the destiny of their class, unquote, he wrote to Lincoln, continuing, quote, just as the American Civil War of Independence initiated a new era of ascendancy for the middle class, so the American Anti-Slavery War will do for the working classes. Now, following the monarchical Tories of the 1770s and the aristocratic slavocracy of the 1860s, a third and much more violent ruling class, represented by Trump, confronts the population. It is not at all an accident that Trump is attempting to rehabilitate the leaders of the Old South. It is as if he is trying to achieve what he thinks America would have looked like if the Confederacy had won the Civil War. But Trump, as well as the 1619 Project, are very wrong about American history. Among the working class's most powerful weapons against oligarchy is the revolutionary legacy of the American Revolution and Civil War. These epochal struggles show that no entrenched power, monarchies, or slaveholders, or capitalists, is beyond the reach of revolution, provided its political program corresponds with the demands of the times. This tradition of radical, universal egalitarianism, born of Enlightenment ideals and carried forward in the Marxist movement, provides the progressive alternative to the politics of racial and division. Democratic National Committee silent on Trump's military takeover of Washington and plans for troops to U.S. cities. By Barry Gray. The Democratic National Committee, which held its summer meeting Monday through Wednesday in Minneapolis, was virtually silent on President Donald Trump's military takeover of Washington, D.C., and his plans to deploy the National Guard in cities across the U.S. On the opening day of the conference, attended by some 400 elected officials, Trump signed an executive order expanding his moves to military dictatorship beyond his August 11th police military takeover of Washington, D.C. He authorized an online portal to recruit ex-police, ex-soldiers, and vigilantes for deployment in Washington and other cities, a paramilitary force under his personal control. The order also instructed Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to create a specialized unit within the D.C. National Guard to put down civil unrest and to ensure that every state's National Guard is trained and available for rapid nationwide mobilization. This means the creation of a standing military police force at the president's disposal, ready to be unleashed against protests, strikes, and political opposition anywhere in the country. On Wednesday, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy announced a further tightening of the Trump administration's grip on the nation's capital, with this department's takeover of management of Union Station. The transportation hub, located near the Capitol, connects regional trains and buses to the Metro subway system and is a key link in the rail system along the East Coast and nationally. Troops and military vehicles have been posted in and around the station since President Trump's August 11th takeover of city policing. White House officials held a news conference there last week that was repeatedly drowned out by protesters. Duffy said the direct government takeover would bring, quote-unquote, better security. The DNC did not even propose a resolution on these police state moves, although the meeting considered a total of 19 resolutions on various issues. There were various rhetorical flourishes from officials attending the meeting, for the most part, characterizing Trump's police state measures as a diversion from the Epstein scandal, inflation, and social cuts and tax breaks for the rich contained in Trump's Big Beautiful Bill. As is typical of the Democratic response, there was no clear warning of dictatorship and no appeal for popular resistance. Representative Robert Garcia, the ranking member of the House Oversight Committee, said, quote, Donald Trump's economic policies are failing, the Epstein file scandal continues to linger, and his public support is dwindling. It's no wonder he seeks to distract the American people. It was all laid down to Trump's personality, in order to conceal the class forces behind the drive to dictatorship and its main target, the working class. But as the World Socialist website stated, on August 26th, Trump is acting on behalf of a financial oligarchy, which is breaking with constitutional forms of rule. The statement went on to explain that American capitalism's debt crisis is such that the oligarchy intends to resolve it by gutting the core social programs of the 20th century, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which account for nearly two-thirds of the federal budget. This requires an unprecedented assault on the working class, which is to be driven into poverty. Trump and the oligarchy he represents know that such an assault will provoke an explosive eruption of working class resistance, hence the preemptive erection of a police state to prepare savage and bloody military repression. The near silence and lack of any serious opposition from the Democratic Party or any other official institution of bourgeois rule is not accidental. As the August 26 WSWS statement explained, the basic class dynamic also explains the role of the Democratic Party. While there may be disagreements over Trump's methods, both big business parties accept that drastic changes in social policy must be imposed at the expense of the working class. The differences are tactical. On the central question, who will pay for the deepening crisis of American capitalism, there is no disagreement. This was on full display Wednesday when Muriel Bowser, the Democratic mayor of Washington, D.C., gave a press conference. She praised what she called the federal surge for bringing down carjackings and said she was, quote-unquote, strategically using federal resources, that is, the police and military occupation, and pointedly said she had spoken to Attorney General Pam Bondi and the president. In other words, her administration was not merely staying silent, but was fully collaborating in the imposition of martial law conditions in the city. The Democratic Party's complicity with the drive to dictatorship at home is complemented by its rabid support for the imperialist war against Russia and Ukraine and its backing of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. The DNC meeting defeated a resolution calling for the suspension of U.S. military aid to Israel. Tariffs will pay for tax cuts for the wealthy, by Nick Beams. From the start of its tariff war against the rest of the world, the Trump administration, from the president down, had been promoting the big lie that its sweeping levies, the highest since the disastrous days of the 1930s, benefit the American population paid for by foreign countries and corporations. Trump knows these claims are false, and that tariffs are the equivalent of a sales tax on imported goods paid for at the border to the government by the importer and then passed to the final consumer or the company using the goods. If not passed on, either by the importer or the company using the goods, then the tariff is paid for by a lowering of the firm's profits because its cost structure had been raised. A report issued by the Nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, last Friday has revealed one of the central mechanisms at work in the tariff war. It is a means by which a domestic tax is levied to pay for the massive tax cut handouts to the corporations and the ultra-wealthy in Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Budget Bill. The CBO said the tariffs announced so far this year would raise more than $4 trillion in the coming decade and be used to cut government deficits by that amount. It said the tariff would lower the primary deficits by $3.3 trillion and the interest bill by $700 billion. It was previously estimated that the hit to government revenue from the Trump budget will be $4.1 trillion over the next decade. In other words, in essence, the tariffs are an impost on the domestic economy to finance the tax cuts. The CBO's estimate of the impact of the budget deficit has been dismissed by the Trump regime, but it eagerly seized on the revenue figures. Trump said it showed he was right, and tariff revenues, quote, are going to reduce the deficit by numbers far greater than ever expected, unheard of, unquote. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has said he expects the revenue from tariffs to rise substantially from previous estimates. He told CNBC, quote, we are going to bring down the deficit to GDP. We'll start paying down the debt, and at that point, that can be used as an offset to the American people, unquote. The tariff hikes have yet to show up fully in consumer inflation data because some firms have taken the decision, at least to this point, not to raise prices in order to retain revenue and market share. But the situation cannot continue indefinitely, and the tariff hikes are already starting to show up in consumer durables. In a recent note, George Saravelos of Deutsche Bank said, quote, the top-down macro evidence is clear. Americans are mostly paying for the tariffs. There is likely to be more pressure on U.S. consumer prices in the pipeline. U.S. corporations have already taken a major hit. General Motors has said that the tariff increases have reduced its profits by more than $1 billion. Nike faces cost increases of $1 billion and has said it is planning surgical prices to try to counter their effect on its bottom line. GM has said it will absorb the tariff blow, as have other firms, but the auto giant is not some kind of benevolent fund. It is engaged in a desperate dog-eat-dog with other auto firms for profit and market share. The laws of this struggle in the capitalist system compel it to try to recoup the tariff costs it has absorbed by extracting greater profits from its workforce via job cuts and intensified exploitation. While the tariff hikes have yet to show up fully in official data, though the lived experience of working-class families tells a different story, they are starting to make their impact. Data released earlier this month showed that wholesale prices, tracked by the Producer Price Index, or PPI, were 3.3% higher in July than the previous year. The reading from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, the head of which was sacked by Trump at the start of the month after a downbeat jobs report, was well above the 2.4% increase in June and the expectation of a 2.5% rise. Commenting on the data to the Financial Times, Bill Adams, chief economist at Comerica Bank, said, quote, tariffs are causing businesses to raise the prices they charge each other, which will show up in higher consumer prices over time. Chris Zaccarelli, chief investment officer at an asset management firm, told the FT that the rise in the wholesale index, quote, shows inflation is coursing through the economy, even if it hasn't been felt by consumers yet, unquote. In an editorial on the PPI jump, the Wall Street Journal, a mouthpiece for sections of the ruling class opposed to Trump's tariff policy because they contravened the free market, said the figures showed we now know who is paying the tariffs. Trump administration officials were anxious to convince voters that someone else, somewhere else in the world, would pay for them instead of American households. But the inflation data told a different story, the Wall Street Journal said. The PPI index got worse the closer you looked, it said. Goods and services both experienced substantial inflation, with increases of 0.7% and 1.1% month on month, respectively. and goods and services related to business investment were becoming pricier. It warned that companies which had absorbed the increased costs, at least for the time being, would not be able to do so forever. The emergence of the facts concerning the impact of Trump's tariffs on the American economy and the working class in the form of rising prices, job cuts, and worsening conditions will not halt the big lie campaign of the Trump regime. Rather, it will be intensified, along with the push to turn once independent organizations, which sought to supply accurate information, into compliant propaganda outlets. That is the meaning of the sacking of the BLS head. As Peter Scher, head of the Macro Strategy and Investment Bank, commented rightly to the FT after the release of the PPI data, quote, "If I were the person who produced the report, I would probably be dusting off my resume." This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.